Part 6. The Bottom of the Commodity Chain. I am human. Nothing human is alien to me. Terence. On the swallowing of little fish, or the type of invisibility that occurs when something is so big you can't see a meaningful piece of it. Up here we chew and chew and chew. 200 meters below the Andaman Sea, the benthic trawl net glides in service. A great maw of oceanic destruction, it greets the seafloor with a wide nylon grin. Calm ahead, roiling on all sides, black plumes of sediment bursting forth like the seabed itself is exploding. The trawl net is many things to many things, but to the bottom of the sea it is a bulldozer and wrecking ball. The giant steel anchor weights plow through the ecosystem, crushing coral, rock, smashing bivalves and crustaceans, obliterating the nooks and crannies where juvenile fish hide and teenagers sneak off to mate. The steel stretches out the lower corners of the net, ensuring the trawl scrapes up everything its bottom lip touches. Fish are attracted by the noise. They stream towards the trawl on instinct, their smaller fish mouths hung open, gobbling in the tumult. The trawl swallows them. The fish don't notice. They swim with it, gamely keeping pace, blinded by the turbidity and feeding. Eventually, unlike the trawl, they are satisfied. Their muscles tire, and their swimming slows as they hang back. But the trawl continues sliding over them steadily. Inch by inch, they slip back into its belly, until finally, they find themselves out of room, pushed up against the cod end, that final narrowest opening in the back, the net within the net. Here, the reality of the trawl changes. The density of fatigued fish increases as they accumulate one by one. First a thick swarm, then fish pinned horizontal to the water flow by the steady addition of newer fish pulled on top of them. If you subscribe to the agony of fish, now is certainly the time, as fatigued fish crowds backward, sideward, and lack of volume turns to pressure, compacting the fish so much that, by the end of the trawl, the first fish captured are nothing more than mash, measured in inches and torn pieces, not saleable as species, their smeared bodies coating the net, flesh pulverized by the relentless pull of the trawl and the succession of maws above. Upward and ahead, following the trawl line at 45 degrees, Tun Lin is on his knees, rocking on the choppy surface of the Andaman Sea. He is in his ripped shorts, a gray-green t-shirt, both his thighs and his arms scabbed raw with a rash from the salt water he's perpetually kneeling in. All around him, endlessly in every direction, the sun bounces hot off the water. Before this boat, Tun Lin had never been on the ocean. He had never seen a living fish, only the dried ones they sold at the market in his village in Myanmar. Now he is head down and intent, staring at the deck, sorting through a mountainous pile of sludge fish, some bending slowly inward, drowsy at death, some thrashing like a dog's tail, some plastic bottles, some blocks of coral, kelp, the membrane of plastic bags. Tun Lin picks through it. Sorts. Different species of fish go on different trays. All are taken back by other men to the freezer. This is Tun Lin's second year on a boat out of what will eventually be 14 years at sea. At this point, he is a slave in the only meaningful sense of the word. He cannot leave. He is not paid. He was brought here a prisoner. He was sold in a cash exchange. He works under the threat of violence, and he has seen those who fought back against that violence killed. His best friend on the boat, and the only person he knew before boarding, is slowly being driven mad. Eventually, this friend, Tu Lek, will get beaten to the point of unconsciousness and then kicked in the chest off the side of the boat to die as the boat chugs on. Tun Lin will feel sad about his best friend's death. He will be terrified by it many years later when we discuss it while trying to reimagine his life on this boat. But he will also feel relief. Tu Lek has been getting increasingly deranged, laughing and crying continuously without warning. His death by the captain has been all but certain for weeks. The death will also open a spot in the bunk they're sleeping in. Tun Lin shares a crawl space with Tu Lek and the rest of the crew, some slaves, some closer to indentured servants, some freemen who signed on of their own volition, some who enforce the captain's orders, many in more than one role depending on the precise time you look, all sleeping together in a space less than a meter high. To get to the bed, they crawl on their hands and knees for about 12 feet into the darkness through an opening that can fit at most one person at a time. This is where Tun Lin sleeps when not working his 20-hour days. When I visit a similar sleeping hole on the Thai docks, The opening comes up just above my knee and is warm, exhaling the dark, yeasty manure smell of the unwashed human body. In 2015, when I connect with Tun Lin for the first time, NGOs estimate 17 to 60% of Thai shrimp includes slave labor, like Tun Lin and its supply chain. 17 to 60% might sound like a wildly high error range, but nobody knows anything in this world. It's divided between those who know nothing and are desperately trying to find out more, and those who know nothing and are financially incentivized to maintain that state. Once imprisoned on his boat, Tun Lin estimates he sleeps less than 5 hours a night. While other Thai fishers I speak with will report being given amphetamines to keep up with the pace, Tun Lin is not given any drugs. The captain provides his crew with instant coffee to eat by the scoop, because there's always fish to catch, nets to mend, a deck to clean. Tun Lin operates the mechanical winch that pulls the swollen trawl net out of the sea, a gargantuan teardrop of dying fish. After guiding it in and dropping it on the deck, his job is to sort the mass. He tosses the large, intact fish to other men who take them for freezing. The smallest fish, of which there are the most these days, the waters exhausted by the trawls, are unsaleable for grocery buyers. Instead, on many boats, these get placed in a series of blue barrels, collected along with ripped fins, mashed tails, crushed mollusks, and other organic debris to be sold for fish meal. Fishers like Tun Lin never see these small, unsaleable fish make it to port. They are passed to a sister boat at a rendezvous, traded along with food, cigarettes, Thai baht, and fuel. This is called transshipment at sea. It saves fuel for the larger refrigerated fishing vessels and allows some boats to stay out almost indefinitely. Resupplied by others, they turn into floating prisons for trafficked workers. The sister boat, the first aggregator among many, will chug off with the catch. From there, the trash fish will get bought by a broker, combined further with others from similar ships, until all are unloaded as small private dock, tossed barrel by barrel onto long ramps with rollers that guide them from the water towards a fish meal factory. There, finally on land, they will be dumped into a giant pile in the hot sun. Within a day, a man with a rake and wearing dark rubber boots will push this pile of fish and fish pieces towards a growling mouth in the cement dock. It looks like a hole in the ground with two grinders on it for teeth, and it takes the rotting fish and pulverizes them further. The scent near the hole is deafening. It blocks out other senses. You close your eyes near this smell. You say, "Excuse me, I cannot hear you or even think very well," to your translator. It is the smell of thousands of tiny rotting fish piled ankle-high in the 90-degree Thai sun on a space that has held ankle-high levels of tiny rotting fish for years. It is a hot smell, not just from the climate and the decomposition, but because there are furnaces just beyond. You can see them glowing behind the man with the rake. The pulverized fish will pass on a conveyor belt toward those furnaces, getting cooked into a paste, then baked into meal. This will then be sold to yet another broker, bought by a feed mill, and blended with inputs from dozens of other facilities, all to create the protein base in pet food, food for fish farms, and feed for hungry little shrimp. Thus is the beginning of the Thai shrimp industry, a billion-dollar complex of activity that pumps 350,000 metric tons of shrimp into the world market each year, just under 10% of the total global supply. It is, depending on when I look during the writing of this book, the second or fifth largest producer after China, and always a top supplier to the United States, which buys more than 50% of its product each year. Shrimp are the single most popular, profitable, and widely consumed seafood in America, more ubiquitous than wedding salmon, tuna for carton sushi, or New England cod. And Thailand is our most sophisticated, developed, and integrated trading partner, largely the result of giant foreign investment developing its aquaculture sector. Once there is fish meal, actual shrimp production can begin. In aquaculture, with the easy ability to transport millions of tiny developing larvae from place to place, this is an oddly disjointed process, completely unlike a farm where animals are raised in a single place before being taken elsewhere for slaughter. Shrimp are raised everywhere, shipped to new, more specialized facilities at each stage, combined with others, then separated back out. The concept of traceability barely makes sense. The first step is the larval stage, and it occurs in a large, humid, warehouse-like space. The one I visit is filled with what look like plain cement sarcophagi, about 40 to a room. Approaching and leaning over the sarcophagi, you find thick troughs of nutrient broth, the color of cola, roiling away with oxygen bubbles. This is a broodstock facility. The air inside is held to a steady, sweaty 88 degrees. If you pull up a sample from these larval pools on day one, it's sea monkeys, motes floating in water, about 500,000 per tank. By day four, these motes will look just slightly alive, like gnats flicking around in Brownian motion visualized. The cola color has faded slightly, and when extracted to a glass beaker for presentation, I think, ah, Harry Champagne. My guide here, an American aquaculture entrepreneur, is leading a tour of businessmen looking to bring shrimp production to their home countries. When a Burmese worker walks in and begins flicking food into the troughs, the entrepreneur incorporates it into his tour seamlessly. Workers don't get a salary, he explains. They get a bonus based on the survivability of the tanks they manage. The owner of the facility, our guide's friend, chimes in, explaining the details. Rule number one when hiring people is you do not hire locals. They will want to go home. They will have families. You want someone who will live here 24 hours a day. If they come from a place at least 12 hours away, the chances of them going home is way down. The businessman scribble notes. These are farmers. They don't work 8-hour shifts. They don't leave the farm. You must think of them that way. If you hire three people to work three shifts on a 24-hour day, all of a sudden you're paying $600, not $200. And that is a cost you can't maintain. Footnote. That's $200 and $600 U.S. dollars per month as reference. End footnote. Then it's back to our lecture on shrimp. As they grow, the larvae are moved to successively larger tanks to accommodate their size. By day 25, they look like black seeds, maybe the size of rye grains. And at this point, if you squint very closely, you can tell each grain of rye is attached to a tiny translucent tail about the size of a fingernail clipping. To harvest them, workers use fine mesh nets swooping in to collect the seeds, draining them like pasta, and then flicking the remainder into a sloshing plastic bag of broth. This bag is then inflated with enough oxygen for shipping, tied off, and packed in a crate. All this happens by hand, totally efficient and low-tech, with workers squatting on an open-air dirt floor, whipping the bags around, pushing them in tight, flies buzzing. To get the count, workers tally each net by hand. I watch two Burmese girls, cheeks stroked with thanaka, doing this at speed, ladling the larva up, squatting, and counting those little black dots before tossing them into bags, again and again until the harvest is complete. Behind them, a buyer leans against his pickup truck, chatting lazily with the owner. Behind them both, a young woman sits at a microscope on a fold-out plastic table. Quality control, brought along at the request of the buyer's buyer's buyer, three notches upstream. And while the Burmese squat and count, and the buyer schmoozes, this woman slices open random bags. At each, she uses a pair of tweezers to prepare a slide, dabbing down the alcohol, smearing the slide cover on top, and cranking the microscope in. There, she jots down notes on color, gut-to-muscle ratio, and size distribution, while a few dogs lie in the dirt beside her, everything and everyone baking in the heat. From here, the black dots head to a hatchery. They are officially no longer larvae, but post-larval shrimp, or PLs for short. As we drive across the Thai countryside, following that pickup, we pass a wreckage of dark lagoons, long stretches of highway lined on both sides by perfectly square ponds, all a murky, stagnant green. We stare out the window at them, all knowing just a little bit about the shrimp industry. One of the businessmen asks, "So, is that the water for the hatcheries?" The American guide laughs, "No, no, no. The water for the hatcheries must be clean. That is wastewater. Miles upon miles of it, gritted out across the landscape like Iowa corn." "That's left over from someone who didn't know how to run their pond right," our guide adds. "It used to be so simple. You'd throw some food in, and the shrimp would grow. Now you have to learn to do it right." At the farm, the shrimp are dumped into a pond in a tumbling black rush. Food goes in next, delivered now by men in a canoe. And finally, a foam aerator is placed on top, beating the water like miniature paddle wheels on a ferry boat. The shrimp continue to expand reliably, gobbling up the fish meal delivered five times daily, excreting lagoons of black shit below. They'll make their home here for the next 3 months. The limit in yield is purely space. Ponds are packed dense with shrimp, up to 90 per square meter. And in the smaller ones, if you miss time or overstock, there are stories of the ripened shrimp rising right out of the water as they grow, like dark popcorn kernels bursting over the pot edge. When they are finally whisked out in large nets at harvest, dipped in a succession of freshwater tanks for cleaning, the long and translucently blue-brown shrimp we know from the nature show emerge. Part whiskered alien, part beady-eyed friend, wriggling 1,000 to a bushel, each armored in its own hazel shell, curling inward like a beckoning finger. These are killed instantly. The same style of plastic barrels used to transport trash fish at sea are filled now with an ice slurry and packed full of the harvest. The temperature shock provokes an immediate and final spasm to each shrimp heart. A cap comes down, sealing them in darkness, and barrel by barrel, they get jammed in the back of a truck for processing. From here, a clock starts ticking. There are 10 hours to get the shrimp from the farm into a bag, and then get that bag frozen to negative 30 degrees Fahrenheit for export. If it's all done in smooth succession, the shrimp can sit in a deep freeze locker for just over 6 months, finally assuming the status of commodity, ready to be traded around the globe at the whims of the market. If there are hiccups, it all crumbles. Each hour of delay translates into weeks, even months, of lost shelf life. A bounty crop responsible for an entire farming community's income can be rendered worthless from a slight glitch. To hedge against this, the harvest is conducted by yet another broker, a woman who temporarily buys each farmer's product, aggregates them with others in the region, and then transports the whole load cross-country to the industrial regions where shrimp is processed for sale. The broker evens out kinks in supply, perhaps selling the bulk of her product to a single plant, and then spreading the remainder across several competitors who are looking to top off. Her first stop is a pre-processing plant. Pre-processors are smaller operations, responsible for peeling and beheading. They're often located in temporary sites, hence the local term, peeling sheds, and range from the truly underground and illicit, dank, fishy spaces where whole families of migrants live on-site and are paid per kilo of shrimp they peel, to meticulous industrial spaces proudly shown off in Western annual reports. Peeling shrimp is delicate labor, and despite all advances in technology, nothing yet can do the work better than small, nimble fingers. Footnote. This multi-channel system exists to meet foreign demand. A supply chain expert explains, the smaller sheds smooth out risk for the entire system. Suppliers who can't commit to regular volume do not get deals with major grocery buyers, and so they turn to the smaller sheds to supplement. When I speak to a Burmese man who worked in one of these sheds, he describes hygiene standards as non-existent, the smell terrible, and the work variable depending on demand. One day, 6 hours of peeling, the next day, 10. And yet, the supply chain expert is right. The spaces are empirically critical supports. In one of the few investigated cases, the product from a single illegal peeling shed was found to have made its way to 4 other, more regulated pre-processing plants and 40 U.S. brands. End footnote. The product from these facilities will be bought by even larger processors above them, those with the giant factories that sell directly to exporters. These facilities operate above ground and above board, registering with industry associations and inspected frequently by teams of auditors. The space I visit is operated by one of the largest seafood processors in the world, a company that buys directly and exclusively from brokers, processors, and ponds that operate under its specifications. It is a model of vertical integration borrowed from the American poultry industry and allows for far greater oversight and control. However, even here, where explicit exceptions are never made, I'm told implicit ones do. If an upstream buyer, e.g. your grocery store, is in need, say the holidays have come and people need their shrimp, there is no hesitation to apply pressure on brokers to increase their supply. That broker must go out and execute, augment, find products somewhere to appease the mouths beyond. The final high-risk room of the factory is the cleanest space I've ever been. Shrimp from all the previous phases of production pass through it, as if collecting a blessing before getting bagged for export. To get there, we walk down a series of highly chlorinated cement steps to a basement, and then push through glowing yellow plastic curtains into a dressing area. Here, we disinfect, leaving our earthly bodies behind. We strip down, removing exterior layers. We wash our hands and forearms up to the elbows. We dab antibacterial gel on our faces. We slide on blue gummy rubber boots, then apply a face mask, a hairnet, a beard protector. Then, on top of all those, a beekeeper-like headpiece with veil. Finally, I'm helped into a gauzy smock and gown. Every inch of my body feels contained. We leave, not via door, but by wading through a crystal-clear, ankle-deep pool to disinfect our boots. The solution remains as perfectly transparent and wavy after we move through as before we entered. On the other side, we head through a sealed door to the line. Walking out, I can see the formerly low-risk shrimp pour into this room through another mechanized hole in the wall. The main line itself is maybe 100 yards long. Today, the workers are preparing shrimp for sushi, some slicing them further, others removing them from steel frames designed to straighten out their natural curl into something more aesthetic. I focus on one woman among the hundreds. She spins and slices a shrimp every 2 to 3 seconds, fingers twirling, head down, a living cog in my diet. Behind her, in a separate process, pink, pre-cooked frozen shrimp are being produced by the ton. They spill out of a kettle hot and steaming before being channeled into a long freezer. I'm told the freezing takes 13 minutes, but of course, the continuous input and output make the whole thing look instantaneous. Thousands of shrimp pouring in one side hot and pink, thousands of shrimp bouncing out the other, now frozen white, plinking down the chute into a succession of plastic bags that shudder past with the automatic rhythm of the factory. They are bags familiar to every frozen aisle of grocery stores across America, complete in every way except one, brand name and logo, afterthoughts to be applied later, just before they are bought, torn open, and dumped into a cook pot for dinner. Huddling and bundling. To fully understand the bottom of the commodity chain, it is helpful to take a step back and look at the concept of commodity as a whole. Whether wheat, iron, almond, or swine, commodities are rooted in fungibility, in an inherent similarity that allows them to be swapped interchangeably without thought or trade-off. The word comes to us etymologically from the French commodité, meaning convenience, and like many conveniences, it stems from simplifying the word. For each good, a series of details is selected, and once chosen, comes to define the whole. An apple for juicing is no longer simply an apple, but a discrete series of apple-y details, from the pH of its flesh to the amount of wax on its skin. A bucket of trash fish becomes protein content alone. The details that are excluded, perhaps the place of origin of that apple, or the precise species of fish in the bucket, quite intentionally vanish. In this way, commodity is an agreement around nuance, a willingness to fix the depth of our scrutiny, and without it, in some form, trade would grind to a halt, fixated on endless, diminishingly small differences. With it, we receive the blessings of uniformity, purchasing at scale, stability through advanced buying, industrial engineering predicated on regularity, the comfort of consistency. The trade-off is one we accept almost unconsciously. After all, as the cliche goes, out of sight, out of mind. But this process has effects. At each step in the chain, through the maze of brokers, agents, and other aggregators who swap goods on our behalf, our visibility grows thinner. The branches of supply transition from manicured arrows on a corporate flowchart into a gnarled thicket on the ground. And rather than fight to see in those spaces, we hire professionals to gloss them over with their professional imaginations, replacing the abstraction of commodity with the colorful inventions of marketing. Suddenly, 100 scattered groundwater reservoirs become a single magical Poland spring. And since we largely accept this trade-off reflexively or allow others to make this trade-off in our name, it is worth considering how the simplifications of commodity, its selective abstraction and filtering of a reality, change not only how goods are bought and sold, but also how they're created to begin with. The simplification of the eye-stalk. The story behind seafood in this country is almost entirely hidden, Katrina Nakamura, an expert on Thai seafood and ethical supply chains, tells me. If you pick a regular everyday seafood product you grew up with, like a can of tuna or bag of frozen shrimp, it looks the same as when you were a kid or when your parents were kids. But the way it is produced as commodity is completely different. Shrimp were, until very recently, a luxury good. As far from commodity as you can get. This is easy to forget in our current era, where runty gray knuckles of the stuff get tossed into everything from $5 lo mein to plastic-domed airport salads. But just 30 years ago, fresh shrimp epitomized class. They cost more than steak, were served at country clubs on silver, and existed as the defining hors d'oeuvre of the Upper East Side. Elite, elegant, expensive. These shrimp were not grown, but caught, trawled for, with nets that swept the middle of the water column. Less bulldozer, more butterfly net. Kinder to the ecosystem than the benthic trawl, but still indiscriminate, inefficient gobblers, ensnaring 5 pounds of unwanted bycatch for every 1 pound of saleable shrimp, and widely hated for killing sea turtles. The boats were also expensive to operate, relying on domestic labor from the Gulf of Mexico, and only out seasonally, two qualities that limited the shrimp supply further, boosting its status as luxury. Aquaculture represented the promise of technology to liberate this luxury and make it available to the common man. And in many ways, the promise has paid off. Since 1980, prices have fallen while production has increased some 3,000%. Shrimp farmers like to point out that some form of aquaculture has been practiced in Southeast Asia for millennia. And certainly this is true. Historically, coastal communities seized on and enhanced tide pools and inlets to create protected ponds for shrimp to grow. The best of these would be washed out naturally, existing as little more than sculpted features of the landscape. And in its early days, industry merely attempted to scale these practices, i.e., maxing out densities, applying consistent management techniques, sharpening the quality of food, and when in doubt, lining everything in plastic. But there was a problem. When shrimp lived in these more confined habitats, their sexual development was stunted by stress. The females simply refused to develop ovaries, which meant humans still had to head to the wild to scoop up natural brood stock. This is a little like farming if farmers first had to scour the forest for crops and then take them back home to replant. It was neither more efficient than trawling for mature shrimp, nor able to guarantee the large quantities needed by the global market to lower price. The single great breakthrough came in a fittingly bizarre and brutal manner. Then, as now, those trying to make aquaculture work raised their shrimp in overcrowded tubs. And as their shrimp swam round and round in circles in these tubs, their outside eye would rub against the side of the tank. And slowly, after God knows how many circles, in God knows what type of crowded environment, the outermost eyeball of the outermost shrimp in these tubs would eventually get rubbed right off, erased by friction. And from this misery, an industry was born. It turns out, for as of yet biologically unexplained reasons, a female shrimp who loses a single eyeball gets fast-tracked through puberty, her ocular loss unleashing a cascade of hormones that begets ovaries in as little as 3 days. This was not predictable, nor does it fit with some grand anatomical theory of shrimp endocrinology, but it is very real. And some supremely attentive farmer noticed it and began snipping eyeballs off by hand in an attempt to replicate it. Soon, the process was studied and verified in the lab, and although nobody could quite explain eye stalk ablation, the quirky stride of science skipped merrily forward, pushing shrimp aquaculture into a new age. Now, instead of relying on natural habitats for broodstock, farmers could breed them indoors. Trawling through estuaries was out. Genetic selection was in. After a decade of highly controlled domestication, shrimp with abnormally large and fleshy tails, fast growth rates, and tolerance for odd diets and turbid water were genetically selected and emerging. The result was nothing short of an economic fairy tale. A once humble farmer could eschew his family's rice paddy, wall off a pond, lower a plastic laundry basket in, and come up with a basket of gold. Or at least a basket of pink gold, which is what the tumbling heaps of flesh came to be known as. A boom ensued. Ponds were dug, mangroves raised, seawalls torn down to allow the salt water to flood in. It was all too easy and too lucrative for the market to ignore. This new shrimp was 4 times more profitable than rice farming. And like any other rush, from gold to diamonds to land, the years that followed were a sordid thing. For this was one of those fairy tales with an ugly moral waiting at the end. First, there was the fuzzy math of ecology. You would think, gee, if we can produce them in farms, then we no longer have to fish as much, Stephen Webster of the Monterey Bay Aquarium tells a PBS camera crew in Empty Oceans, Empty Nets. In fact, the opposite is true. Regardless of where shrimp are raised, they are still carnivorous, and thus, rather than silencing the trawls, the bloom of aquaculture encouraged them to take an even larger catch. It takes 2 pounds of wild-caught fish to create 1 pound of shrimp. And with aquaculture increasing the total supply of shrimp 5 times from the late 1970s, it forced the fish trawls to operate at 10 times capacity. Daniel Murphy, an expert on Thai seafood supply chains, explains the ripple effects. There were never, and there still are no, exclusively trash fish boats. They are a byproduct of boats willing to do market with a lower level trade, and they exist because there is money there. To wrangle the trash fish arriving in uneven amounts from tens of thousands of unaligned boats, the industry relied on brokers, who in turn relied on sub-brokers traveling port to port. These brokers and sub-brokers blended product from different boats, each finding their edge by upgrading a substandard catch, or merging bad actors and honest fishermen alike. Footnote. I'm sure the more observant can already see the horrid ecological sidebar here. As the boats began receiving regular payments for their trash fish, they trawled for them more intentionally, exhausting the local waters of smaller fish, degrading the fishery. Over the decades, a cycle developed. The more the fishery degraded, the harder it became to land the more expensive species everyone originally came for, the more the trawls relied on netting smaller fish for aquaculture. Eventually, there was a crash. Catch per unit plummeted, and with waters barren, the boats chugged on to do it all again, somewhere new. End footnote. Then there's disease. As with any group of animals raised in a concentrated, confined space, and especially one soaking in a broth of its own feces, shrimp, in captivity, became far more susceptible to disease. And when a pond spoils, it spoils all at once. One day you have several hundred thousand healthy, wriggling post-larvals. The next day you pull up a net to find your shrimp listless and deformed. After that, all is rot. The entire pond is not just worthless, but toxic, a stew of dead and dying animals that need to be drained and shoveled wet into disposal. And then the disease spreads to your neighbor. A cycle of spectacular growth, overnight riches, and then sudden collapse came to define the Asian shrimp industry. It is a cycle that rolls across the globe, seeking out new, untouched territory, from Thailand onto Vietnam, onto Indonesia, then India, a movable gold rush of pink gold, where the promises remain the same and the failures come in new, innovative forms as the diseases continue to mutate. Jonathan Shepard, former head of the International Fish Meal and Fish Oil Organization, has estimated the collective toll as ranging up to $20 billion and calls shrimp aquaculture virtually uninsurable. It's an industry for gamblers, betting they can ride a region hard before some new ecological crash. But as any gambler knows, the house always wins. And for shrimp, the crash and boom are regional events, while the global story is one of growth, continuous output, and considerable wealth. And so, amid the individual ruin, an industry arose, those pre-processors, brokers, exporters, fish meal factories, and trash fish boats, all forming a beating economic heart that didn't care where the aquaculture farmers were located or what ecological havoc had been wrung, but did have new, much-needed jobs to offer and did need the blood of able-bodied men and women to run. An able-bodied man. I first meet Thun Linh sitting on the side of a barbecue in a cement alleyway in exurban Thailand. It's well over 90 degrees in the evening, and the mosquitoes hang big and fat in the air, lethargic from hours of blood-sucking. I have come as a guest of a local NGO called the Labor Protection Network, or LPN, which promises to show me around the area's shrimp production plants. We are all drinking warm beer with crushed ice out of highball glasses. A long picnic table is laid with all the fixings for a Thai feast, white tendon meat stacked in swatches, pats of lard, bowls of gray-yellow sprouts, and 3 giant stainless steel pots simmering away with red oils and coconut milk. Everyone mills and chatters in the way of NGO gatherings around the world. There's a man with a guitar and a group of interns gathered around him. Thun Linh is sitting by himself on the side, hunched and apart, not so much lost in thought as eyes darting and nervous. He looks lonely and non-threatening enough that I, who know nobody here, feel like I can drag my translator over and approach him. He is holding a baseball cap in one hand, and my first thought meeting him is that he's balled his fist so tight holding that cap, it looks like there's no hand at all. I think this is a man so tightly wound he's erasing himself. It's only at the end of the night, when I go to say goodbye, that I realize the cap was resting gently on his knee, and rather than being balled up tight, he was missing his hand completely. It was torn off at sea. We meet again the next day, and then on and off again for the next 2 months. I learn Tun Lin isn't nervous so much as he's a blank man. He exudes a negative charisma. There are several other fishermen I hang around with that I might even say I am friends with. We get along, drink, laugh. Not Tun Lin. He agrees to meet and tell his story. But despite the succession of lurid details, he is desensitized to the point of almost being boring at it. He is, however, patient, and I think that's why I'm drawn to him. I get the sense he neither wants to exaggerate nor escape his past. He corrects me too often. Mostly I spend my time with Tun Lin thinking how the questions I'm asking him are just illusions of understanding, figuring out the precise way a trawl net is hauled in, or how he felt the moment something unimaginable occurred just magnifies our differences. It invites me for a moment to feel like I might connect, and then reminds me how false that is. And I appreciate that failure. It feels like the most honest exchange we can have. He tells me he's from Wabi, a tiny village in the Mon state of Myanmar, just north of the capital, Molamin. His father is a soldier. His mother is a Morphe, which is alternately translated as shaman, fortune teller, or necromancer. He remembers his parents as reasonably happy. Life was not easy, but there was a minimum sort of stability his father's post provided. Then, in the late 1990s, the army calls his father to serve. There's no simple frame of reference for rural Myanmar at this time. It is feudal and corrupt, trapped in time without electricity, running water, or paved roads, yet bedecked with assault rifles. Tun Lin doesn't grow up with a floor, but he does remember his father's M16 leaning against the walls of their hut. Transportation to the front is largely on ox-drawn carts. The country at this time is in perpetual civil war, between the government and the communists, between small mercenary armies funded by industrialists and rival tribes, between ethnicities and religions in the different subregions, all of whom ally with each other and disband and realign to create chaos. When his father leaves, his mother runs off, leaving him with his older sister. They lose their house. And suddenly, at 14 years old, Tun Lin has almost nothing. After a week of homelessness, his older sister finds a small house outside the village, and she takes him in. The house is made entirely of bamboo, dried and woven, and when it rains, the water comes through the roof in fat, slow drops. Or as he says, it's fit for people to sleep in, not to live. In the village, he becomes an outcast. When he stops going to school, people say he is stupid and illiterate. When things go missing, people call him a thief, an accusation he denies years later with an anger that's heartbreaking. A friend's mother tells him his mother was a prostitute and that he's a bastard. Then his father returns with an aunt who is also displaced by the war, and all of a sudden, there are four people in his sister's tiny house. It is at this point, wet and cramped each night, that he begins to dream of working in a Thai factory. The way he describes these dreams, they feel so universal, almost charmingly adolescent dreams of becoming the family savior, and yet so agonizingly specific to Myanmar during its civil wars. In Wabi at this time, there are simply no jobs outside the army. Most of the people Tun Lin knows collect wood from the forest, which they take to the state capital to sell as firewood. If they are lucky, they earn a few pennies. It is a community undone, starving to death. Tun Lin tells me he doesn't really know what a factory is, only that people work hard there and make good money. But he dreams of a factory every night. He thinks he can make money and bring it back to his family and buy them a real house. And so after weeks of four people living under a roof that had barely fit two, Tun Lin decides he needs to make his dream real. He leaves without telling anyone, bringing three t-shirts, three pairs of pants, one blanket, and the shoes he is wearing. He doesn't have a proper bag, so he uses a plastic one. He crosses the border to the town of Miaudi. It is easy. He does that by himself, without a broker or snakehead, just a matter of hitching a ride and dashing across a river a few meters down from the official checkpoint. When I visit Miaudi 18 years later, I see several people doing the same thing. From there, he walks up the steep bank and emerges on the Thai side of the border. into a town called Mai Sat. He is alone. The reality of being in Thailand, of the language being different, of knowing absolutely no one hits home. And as that reality hits, a broker waves to him. Thun Linh says it seems like he was waiting for him. Thun Linh says it was such a relief. The broker is about 40 years old, his eyes smart and handsome, dressed in a blue long-sleeved shirt that is clean. So Thun Linh approaches, and the broker asks him in Burmese, "Where would you like to go?" And Thun Linh says simply, "Thailand," not totally realizing he's already in Thailand. Then he realizes and becomes ashamed and tells the broker he wants a job but doesn't have any money. The broker says that doesn't matter and puts his arm around him. The two of them walk back to a two-story brick house in Mai Sat. They walk side by side like they're on a date. The whole time they talk in Burmese about Thailand. Thun Linh is very excited. The broker is laying out a future, telling him about the different cities in Thailand, the resorts in the south, the skyscrapers in Bangkok, the factories in Samut Sakhon, and of course, he is telling him all about the jobs and money there. When they arrive at the brick house with the red roof, the broker lets him inside. There are over 100 other migrants there, waiting, spread out over the floors, some with bedrolls and suitcases, most like Thun Linh, with little more than plastic bags stuffed with clothes. The broker explains to Thun Linh that he doesn't live at the house, but that he will be back. And so Thun Linh takes up a place on the floor. The first thing he's told while sitting on that floor, he is very lucky. One of the migrants near him explains that Thun Linh has come at a very good time. It has been hard at the house. Some people have been waiting on the floor for over a week. But Thun Linh learns he should be very excited, because the next day they are set to leave. True to the word, the next morning, the broker arrives. He tells them they are going to Chiang Mai, a city in the north. But he tells the group that the police are looking for migrants. They are making his job very difficult and dangerous. He explains that the military is pulling vehicles to the side and checking papers. So to get to Chiang Mai without being arrested, they will have to go by foot. It is a 210-mile trek through a jungle, over several mountains, during the heart of the rainy season. Thun Linh does not know this because the broker does not say this. The broker does not take any questions or explain anything beyond how they are to leave town without attracting attention. Thun Linh is just excited to start. It rains continuously the first day of the walk, and quickly the group begins to break down. Many were sick and starving before leaving. Every night they sleep outside, huddled in groups under trees or in small caves and overhangs in the mountain areas. The only food comes at two checkpoints per day, where the guide has arranged for meals to be stashed. Each of these meals is identical, tinned mackerel and tomato sauce. It is not one man per can. Thun Linh says they split cans three, four, or five people per can. Thun Linh estimates that a group of 100 people left the house. By the end of this trip, he knows for a fact he saw six people die of hunger or disease. On the last day, they have to cross a pass near the tallest mountain in Thailand. They are in the Ap Long National Park and told to move very fast because there are police looking for them. Thun Linh's legs ache. What were blisters on day two are now wet blood. The skin on his heel is slowing off, and at the top of the mountain, he remembers a final person dying of fatigue when all they had to do is walk downhill. That night, they arrive in Chiang Mai and are told they can sleep and do not have to walk anymore. The next morning, several trucks arrive at the campsite. From here, the group is divided and everyone is told to get into one. Thun Linh describes his truck as small, more of a pickup with a shell. Inside there are benches, and the shell has no windows, so it's impossible to see out. His group is about 20 people, and Thun Linh is certain it is impossible for them all to fit. But they file in anyway. They sit in rows so tightly packed it's hard to breathe. Then the door is closed. It is dark. No one speaks. Thun Linh is not on one of the benches, but sitting on the floor with his knees tucked to his chest. He closes his eyes and tries not to think. Estimating from a map, driving with no traffic, their trip lasts 12 hours. He tells me there are no rest stops, and that people cannot control themselves and they urinate and defecate in the truck. When they arrive, the back of the truck is opened and they are told to get out. One by one they unfold. People are crying. A woman near Thun Linh has died. She was suffocated or crushed. Thun Linh does not know which, only that he had sat so close to her the entire trip and that he had not thought about her. They emerge from the darkness of the truck into the darkness of a gated parking lot. It is night, and a new broker, a man to whom they've been bequeathed, begins dividing them into smaller groups. Tun Lin and several other men are separated out, placed in a car. They drive a few short minutes, then are brought to another house. This is Samut Sakhon, shrimp processing capital of Thailand. Tun Lin is led to a room with 25 others. The door is opened, and he is locked in. It is only now, looking around at the 25 other men in the room, that Tun Lin realizes something is wrong. The room has no bed and no mattresses, but does have a partition for a toilet. There are no blankets, just a room with a wooden floor and 25 grown men starving in it. By this point, Tun Lin has lost his plastic bag and has been separated from all his possessions except his traditional Burmese pants, which he has been wearing continuously since crossing the border into Mae Sot. In the room, he makes his first and only friend, Tu Lik. A small man, Tu Lik is also Burmese and from the Mon State. Later, when they work on the boat, they will sleep next to each other, share food. When I ask if he has any good memories of Tu Lik, whom he calls his best friend, Tun Lin says no. He says from this point forward, there are no good memories. Then he stops and thinks and tells me, sometimes at night when they are lying quiet but awake, Tu Lik turns to him and asks for his sister's number and jokes that he would like to call her to ask her out. Their door opens twice a day when food is delivered. Two large pots are pushed on the floor to them. One has rice. The other is filled with a Burmese stew of pork and curry. It is the same stew each day. Tun Lin calls it delicious. Despite 25 men sharing two pots of food, there is no fighting. Tun Lin says everyone understands that getting in a fight amongst themselves will provoke the broker and they'll be beaten. After a week in this house, he's called out of the room. A man tells him he should be very happy because he will make a lot of money. The man gives him more food. Tun Lin tells me that years later, this man will be murdered by another fisher seeking revenge. The man tells Tun Lin he will work on a fishing boat for 3 months to pay off the debt of being smuggled, and then, after those 3 months, he will be paid. Tun Lin doesn't believe him. But the next day, the man takes him and several others from the room to get their pictures taken for a seaman's log. From there, he is placed on the boat. It is mid-sized, about 60 feet long with a dark blue hull, a white band around a two-story pilot house. And before Tun Lin fully understands, the boat has left. He has received no training. Very quickly, he learned he doesn't want to work on the boat. But it's too late. They're out at sea. During his first night in the boat, he's convinced he will die there. He's terrified of the water. He cannot eat because he's seasick and throws everything up. And he's not allowed to sleep. This continues for 3 days. It is at this point the captain pulls out the big canisters of instant coffee for the crew to eat. On the fourth day, doing work he does not understand, among men who speak languages like Khmer and Lao, he can only partially communicate with, nauseated, starving, exhausted, Tun Lin says he becomes physically unable to continue working. And so he stops and goes to the crawl space to take a nap. This is his first beating. The captain finds him asleep. He then wakes Tun Lin up with a weapon my translator insists on calling a yo-yo. It's a steel ball on an elastic cord, and he swings it at Tun Lin, catching him across the face, then repeatedly on the shoulders. Tun Lin shows me his scars. He says he's beaten many times over the years, but he will always remember this first one. Tun Lin says he's not beaten again after this. The captain merely has to point at this yo-yo for Tun Lin to increase the speed of his work. Until, after waiting 6 months, he makes the mistake of asking for the salary he was promised. For this, he is beaten even harder than before. He learns now the captain owns him, that he bought him when he acquired his debt. His friend Tu Lik simply can't handle it. He's only a teenager and is weak, which means he is beaten more frequently. As the captain whips him, Tu Lik slowly loses his mind. After a particularly bad beating, Tu Lik gets very sick. He can't walk, and he's allowed to rest for 2 days straight to recover. The ship captain provides Tu Lik with medicine and lets him sleep in his own bed. For the next week, the captain lets him do light labor like helping him supervise and release the net. But Tun Lin knows things are wrong. Whenever he asks Tu Lik questions, the boy will only laugh or cry. Soon after Tu Lik refuses to work, it is now that he's beaten until he's unconscious and kicked into the sea. Months at sea pass into years. Tun Lin adjusts. He never enjoys life on the boat, but he learns it. He becomes good at it. He comes to do every job, sorting the fish. carrying them to the freezer on trays, patching, folding, caressing the net, looking for rips, and supervising the entire 6-hour process it takes to haul it in. He learns the rhythms. His boat goes to port every 4 months, and Tun Lin watches new men come on. He knows when these men will be beaten, and he knows the work they must do to avoid it. It is tempting to wonder why, when the boat comes to port, Tun Lin does not jump off, flee, escape from this nightmare. But he and many other fishers I speak with correct this misunderstanding. You can escape, but you cannot escape, one fisher tells me. They are at ports in countries thousands of miles away from Thailand, which is itself a country that is not their own. They do not speak the language, they have no money, and no possessions they can barter for money. And they are illegal in body and mind at this point, without papers or passports, living in constant fear of arrest. There's also great collusion, not only among boat owners who enforce a code looking out for one another's men, but also among boat owners and police. I speak to one fisher who was on a boat stopped by Thai authorities for environmental violations and who took a desperate risk to tell those authorities he was being held against his will. Instead of rescue boats, NGOs, and the media helicoptering in, the captain pays a bribe to preserve his catch and make the environmental violations go away. And, as an aside, one of the authorities tells him about his snitch. When the fisher tells me this story, he says that he feels lucky to be alive. Others tell me stories, perhaps fictional, perhaps real, about fishers who escape only to starve, forced to live in the jungle on the edge of ports thousands of miles from home, eating stray dogs and attempting to dig for cassava on beaches. These stories of failed escapes are literally beaten into fishers by their captains. Rescue workers who help repatriate them will talk about this fear even when long off the boat. I hear rumors of hidden tracking devices placed on them by the captain and private jails run by the owners where they will be detained. The message is, we will find you. We own you. There is no hope out there for you. So Tun Lin never escapes. But then, after 5 years on this boat, an odd thing happens. Catches me off guard in the interview, and so I'll just write it the way Tun Lin explains it. He is let off the boat. Tun Lin says he waited until the boat came to shore. He believes that if he asked at sea, his captain might kill him. But at port, with laws, he feels he will be safer. Other fishers tell me that after 5 years on a boat, you had worked off your debt. But Tun Lin insists this isn't the case for him, and that he just asked. Either way, after 5 years on this boat, without pay or sleep, when in a port in Indonesia, Tun Lin asks this captain if he can leave, and the captain says yes. He is given no wages, but since he is let off, not an escapee, he is also allowed to board a sister boat in the fleet going back to Thailand. In Thailand, he finds work in a fish processing plant, where he stays for 2 months. He works with one other man, pulling meat from the bone and shoving it into 1 kilogram plastic sacks. Because Tun Lin is illegal, the owner insists that he live on the premises, and he locks the door at night from the outside. His own room is a cell. But this does not seem to bother Tun Lin. What does bother him is that the owner charges him for this room and for electricity, and because of that, he makes no money at this job. And so he asks around, finds another captain, and returns to sea. And if your head is spinning, let it spin. Tun Lin has no documents and no way of getting a legal job. He tells me after 5 years at sea, he feels like he knows which captains will be abusive and which will be fair. He says he knows the job of fisherman and is experienced. He says he has learned bits of Thai and can ask to work on different parts of the boat doing easier work. And he also tells me that on the new boat, he can become a boss. And so he enlists. On the new boat, he trains the new fishers. He says this is very hard, that they learn slowly. And when I ask if the people he was training were legal migrants or men enslaved just like he had been, he says he doesn't know. Then, after a moment of silence, he says he asked the ones who spoke Burmese, "How did you end up here?" And they told him they were tricked. At this point, he's 22 years old. He continues working on this and then other boats for the next 12 years. He's now a supervisor. He tells me he's nice and does not beat his men. At one point, he loses his hand. It is ripped off when he is adjusting a rope called the yaw yap. He's wearing gloves, so he doesn't even know he's lost 2 fingers until he takes the glove off. At a resupply, he's placed with his heavily bandaged hand on the transport boat and taken to an Indonesian hospital. where the doctors amputate the rest of his fingers to save his arm. Then, after a month in the hospital, he checks out and gets on a new boat. Fishing is what he knows. Tun Lin finally gets off all boats in November 2014 when a high-level diplomatic dispute over environmental damage causes Indonesia to aggressively cancel Thai fishing concessions in its territorial waters. Tun Lin's boat happens to be there. When it is detained, he realizes the ship's captain will be unable to pay the crew their wages and unable to pay a bribe to wriggle free. And so Tun Lin becomes a whistleblower, too. From this, he meets the LPN, the NGO hosting the barbecue where I meet him, who are working with international aid organizations and the Burmese embassy to help trafficked fishermen aboard these boats. No doubt, due to his lost hand, he gets outsized attention from authorities looking into illegal fishing. Then he is sent back to Thailand and sent to live in a camp for trafficked migrants. He's officially labeled a victim, which becomes a new form of paralysis. He is still illegal in the eyes of the Thai government, still unable to get work. And while he could sneak back to the boats, that would prevent him from getting any compensation for the 5 years he was enslaved. Instead, he waits. Lately, he has been volunteering with the LPN, helping educate other migrants. Once, after talking for hours on a patio, I asked Tun Lin whether he thinks his story is typical or exceptional for fishermen. It is a question I almost immediately regret because there's no way for him to answer. Tun Lin just nods. All the fishermen have different stories, he says, but mine is not typical. I feel very lucky. Replacement theory of migrants. If we pull back from Tun Lin, we can see the outlines of something much larger than just his story. Up through the 1980s, much of fishing in Thailand occurred right off the coast. At this time, the Gulf of Thailand was still quite resource-rich, and trash fish were still trash, pushed right back off the deck to the water because they were not worth their weight in the hold. The workers on these fleets were entirely Thai. Some worked year-round, but most were from the northeast, participating in a great seasonal migration that stretched back centuries. The work those fishers describe was hard. Northeasterners are famously the poorest Thais, and there were certainly abuses like underpayment and withheld wages. But even in the worst cases, their boats went out for 2 to 3 weeks at a time, and since everyone spoke the same language, word of an unpleasant employer spread quickly. But then things changed. First, there was the storm. In 1989, a monsoon over the Gulf of Thailand hits an exceptionally warm air pocket and rapidly intensifies into Typhoon Gay. 162-mile-per-hour winds rise from nowhere to catch the Thai fishing fleet unaware at sea. Hundreds of boats sink. The tragedy is not something that really comes down to numbers. It's a national shock, an unthinkable disaster, almost in the way of September 11th. Every Thai fishing family loses someone. There's talk of ghosts at sea, of carnivorous fish living off the bodies of the dead. Fishing becomes stigmatized. Many in the Northeast stop eating seafood altogether. At the same time, the first aquaculture boom finally hit. Thai shrimp production leaps, and foreign investment rushes in to catch it. Refrigerator docks are erected, export facilities built, and hundreds of processing plants spring to life to cater to the heaps of product coming in from the rapidly developing farm sector. These all need workers. Now, instead of going down south to fish, the Northeasterners have the choice to stay on land. And in the shadow of Typhoon Gay, it's an easy one. Which means all of a sudden the fishing industry is hit with a massive labor shortage, and it comes at the very moment the job itself has become much less attractive. After decades of overfishing, catch volume in the Gulf of Thailand flatlines. Nets that used to come up wriggling now come up flaccid. As we enter the 1990s, the fishing fleets are forced to move farther out into deeper water. And so purely out of economic necessity, the industry moves to a new model. One boat acts as a mothership, another carries fish to and fro. The era of transshipment at sea has begun, and boats that were once rarely out for a single month now routinely stay out for a year. And so now, in addition to the physical storm of Typhoon Gay, we have a perfect causal storm of events. A huge labor shortage hits at the exact moment international industry arrives. Job quality plummets, and a massive vulnerable population of migrants waits desperate at the border. The final factor isn't part of the storm at all. It's a universal constant, racism. Despite being geographic neighbors, the Burmese are slightly darker skinned, wear a different style of clothes, use different forms of makeup, and speak in 100 different dialects and languages, all incomprehensible if you're Thai. Nationalist politicians in Thailand seize on this and call migrants a danger to the public order, responsible for high birth rates, disease, and crime against Thais. It's overheated rhetoric that successfully leads to brutal enforcement. There is the migrant code, I hear. Never look a police officer in the eye. You'll be hit for it. Legal migrants are stopped for papers when they go out, detained on completely illegal pretexts. Illegal migrants face an even deeper web of threats, from arrest, physical abuse, extortion, and extended detention. Police patrol like sharks, Phil Robertson, deputy director of Human Rights Watch's Asia Division, tells me. They make a lot of money this way. When a migrant is stopped, the squeeze begins. The migrant either loses money from their job for lost wages, or they lose money to the police directly as a bribe. Or, if they cannot pay the bribe, they may become money, sold from prison to a labor broker who will sell them on at a profit. From here, everything proceeds reasonably to completely unreasonable ends. As the boats become progressively worse places to work, their owners are forced to offer more money up front. These are lucrative sums, 6 months to 1 year of salary in advance, enough to ruin the fleet if the men don't appear. Since many migrants are illegal, don't speak the language, and are often smuggled directly from their home countries, they cannot negotiate with boat owners directly. Instead, a broker is used, a single profession responsible for balancing the giant vortex of need that is the Thai labor shortage with the giant vortex of need that is the poor Burmese looking for jobs. And this broker is often doing that balancing illegally, at a service to both parties, while hated by the state. Suddenly, it becomes a system where everyone is owed something, and thus everyone can feel aggrieved. The owner, who might go bankrupt if the men he paid for in advance do not appear, or if they appear and flee because they decide they hate the work. The broker, who's risking his liberty, dodging the police and smuggling men who asked for his help. And the migrant, to whom so much has been promised, but who slowly comes to understand that none of those promises came free. Of course, it is this last piece, the migrant's obligation, that is the most profound. Even in the softest sense, it acts as a restraint, a stay that keeps him working a job he might otherwise leave. And since employee turnover is one of the highest costs of production, this very fact makes him a more desirable class of employee. It's a testament to the retina-scarring brilliance of market capitalism that this tiny source of value cannot go unnoticed, even if one wants to look away. It need not ever be explicitly stated or accepted. It can, in fact, be hated. But eventually, even an ethically upstanding factory owner might give in and let subcontractors handle hiring, opting to be grateful for the efficiencies they bring. After all, the first world grocery buyers above never come to offer owners like him more money. In fact, every few years it seems the buyer visits to offer him less, as that buyer is competing for customers back home, and so paying a living wage makes it impossible to compete. Then one day, minimum wage becomes too much, and to supply the workers they have slowly become addicted to, a new class of brokers emerge. Brokers like Tun Lin's, who sell men to other men and wipe their hands clean. And here grocery has one last trick. It allows us to hate our shrimp and eat it too. The image of the bad, polluting aquaculture farmer or vulnerable, exploited migrant gets imprinted on our first world brain, while the fungibility of commodity goods, that maze of brokers and agents, gives the entire system the plausible deniability it craves. We might demand action about horrid conditions, but the idea of asking us to forgo shrimp, even momentarily, and fill our nonstick woks with some other protein is precisely the type of inconvenience the entire system is built to protect against. And the supermarket is left alone to figure out a solution. Big supermarket buyers feel tremendous pressure from their customers to improve these situations, Corey Pete, an expert on Thai aquaculture, tells me, and they turn to third-party certification, the only tool they have. It may be a bit ridiculous to show up at a Thai shrimp farm with standards that are 100 pages long in English talking about the proper format of a pay stub, but that is what happens. In the buyer's hands, those certifications become a magic wand. They empower and absolve at the same time, shifting an enormous burden onto a single participant in the exchange. I've seen buyers for major American retailers say, "You get this certification or we won't buy from you," Corey tells me. That's not corporate responsibility. That's extortion. And as each new first world demand comes down, each new certification gets put in place, the farmers, brokers, and boat operators have to figure out how to be profitable yet again. But when you peer into their cost structures, there's very little these producers actually control. Pathogen-free brood stocks, environmental-friendly medication, enhanced refrigeration systems, and payments for the audits for each are all new top-down demands that do not lead to higher selling prices. They are costs paid to gain entry, Paying them simply makes a product acceptable enough to play the commodity game along with everyone else. One of the only places a producer feels in control is labor, and so labor is where cuts occur. These producers are caught in a nightmare, a shrimp supply expert tells me, facing increasing demands from buyers, trying to lower the cost of labor to pay for them, all while trying to retain people who don't want to do the job to begin with. The most unusual aspect of Thai slavery is that you're hearing about it at all. The LPN started as a children's education camp, a kind of after-school program targeted directly at migrant children. In 2004, Patimatong Puchayakal, known to everyone as Pion, and her partner, Sompong Sakrao, moved to Samut Sakhon, a vast industrial city outside of Bangkok. They were recent university graduates, idealists, and had decided to try to raise awareness for the growing plight of migrant labor in Thailand. Neither had a personal connection to migrants, nor to the seafood industry that defined the region. It was just a place with a need. They did know about childhood education and community development. This was their area of training. And so with the help of a tiny grant, they began running a series of camps and activities for migrant children. In many ways, they offered little more than a warm place to go. But that was more than anyone had ever offered the migrants in the area before. Pion and Sompong led the children in games and songs, taught basic language skills, and worked to enroll whoever was willing in school. It was the most basic curriculum, teaching love, respect, and above all, offering children who had never belonged anywhere a place where they were valued. Almost immediately, they discovered something. Working with children was a backdoor to building trust with their parents. These parents were migrants whose fear of exposure made them even more marginalized than their children. Pion watched as they skirted the edges, wary of surfacing enough to even pick up their own kids. But as trust was created with the children, the parents started coming forward. They often relied on their own children as translators, and they often came asking for help from these two teachers who their children promised would listen. The help they asked for was beyond anything Pion or Sompong had ever heard. These were stories I've just related, of being held captive, of breaking free, of beatings and threats, of pay stubs with only deductions, of being unable to speak the language well enough to ask why. And dutifully, Pion and Sompong would take those stories and go to the local police and make a report on behalf of the migrants, and watch as nothing changed. There are two very understandable paths here. One is to continue listening to these stories, continue reporting them, and realize that in this world, there are forces bigger than you, forces beyond your control, and that fighting against them directly will only wear you down. That is, to resign yourself to making the small, meaningful contributions that make up day-to-day life, continuing to fight through the kindness of one-on-one interactions. Or you can hear these stories and become radicalized. Pion is not what you think. She is small. There's just a hint of a snaggletooth on a perfectly round face. She has a black patch of a birthmark under her left eye like a shiner that is spread across her cheek in a smudge. She is in her late 30s, but there's a crinkle around her eyes, hair that is just going gray. And with her small size and friendliness, her careful motions and baggy clothes, there's something grandmotherly there. She persistently avoids TV interviews, always pushing others in front of her when asked, always saying her story is unimportant and will only get in the way. It all fits together so when she smiles at you with those crinkly eyes and snaggletooth, you will think Pion is very kindly. But it's a kindness that feels a little shy and awkward. Like maybe you'd have to look out for Pion at a busy event, check in on her to make sure she's okay, because maybe Pion is someone who could become overwhelmed and needs protection. Nothing could be further from the truth. If she didn't repeatedly explain how terrified she was, I would take Pion to be fearless. This is a woman who's led midnight raids on illegal processing plants, who's faced down men 6 inches taller than she is, twice her weight, and who has pushed past them without a glance, who has had men who kill and men who hire killers scream at her to mind her own business, to do something else with her life, to stay away from their workers, who carries a screwdriver and hammer on every raid because she personally is adept at using them to pop open the locks that are keeping the migrants inside, who, if necessary, will do these raids unaccompanied by the police and press, because although she always alerts the authorities, she has found they do not always follow through. A Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist tells me, Pion goes in. She does the really dirty stuff. It is dangerous. Fishery owners, the multimillionaires who run Samut Sakhon, have shown up at her house with cash, cars, and gold. When she refused one, he calmly explained he would chop her body into small pieces. And for each threat like this, and there have been many, She has reflected on the experience and decided to go back out and do it again. It's the type of swallowed fear, or perhaps tolerated fear, that teaches a lesson about the difference between bravery and bravado, between persistence and confidence, about how completing difficult tasks has less to do with complicating a situation with reams of affirmation and more about starting with whatever's in front of you and accepting there's always more. Over the last 10 years, Pion has personally rescued more than 2,000 migrants and has been indirectly responsible for the rescue of thousands more, facts that seem to sadden her more than give her peace if you bring them up, because she sees her ability to have an outsized impact as precisely the point, the most obvious representation of the scale of the problem, a question she will never directly pose because that's not Pion's style, but that goes a little something like, if she personally has had this impact just by listening and following through, what would the world look like if others acted on their instincts too? When Pion and Sumpong radicalized in 2006, they decided they were going to build a network of migrants. They wanted to build something strong on the local level that could take care of its own. And the first step they took down this path was to help migrants to document their own experiences. Rather than make a series of isolated reports, they started bringing in workers to give testimonials, compiling their experiences with others to build cases. It was participatory action research, and the very process created the network they envisioned, using action to build trust, and trust to give those marginalized and voiceless a reason to speak. One of the first cases they began documenting was on beriberi. Beriberi is a disease where the hands swell and delirium sets in. It comes on with sudden immobilizing pain in the arms and legs and can be devastating. And in 2006, the LPN learned that there were 39 returned fishermen in Samutsukan who had it. This did not make much sense. As conditions go, beriberi is rare, but certainly not unheard of. It is a nutrient deficiency. It isn't contagious. It comes from a severe lack of vitamin B, thiamine. And as the LPN investigated, they learned that there were occasional clusters of beriberi in refugee camps, which did make a little sense, a common group starving together. But why fishermen? And why in Thailand, where there were plenty of cheap foods that supplied the needed thiamine? And so the LPN got out and investigated. They talked to migrants. And because they were trusted, people opened up in ways they hadn't to the medical task force that had previously investigated. The more the LPN listened, the more they connected the dots. It turns out eating raw fish and seabirds also strips the body of thiamine. And soon, the LPN was documenting something much bigger than beriberi. Simply by talking to people nobody in official government positions was asking about, they uncovered some of the first cases of human trafficking in seafood. From 2006 to 2012, the LPN rang the alarm bell to everyone they could think of. They told the United Nations, the International Labor Organization, countless NGOs. They alerted the press. Reporters Shannon Service and Becky Palstrom visited with them three times to create a brilliant piece for National Public Radio. Slow gears started moving. But in general, despite uncovering an industry in the 21st century where human slavery was not just common but flourishing, things continued pretty much as normal. Shrimp, chocolate, coffee, cattle, cotton, timber, sugar, palm oil, and gold. In a parallel universe, the nonprofit Humanity United was attempting to tackle the same issues from the top down. Founded in 2008 by eBay billionaires Pierre and Pam Omidyar, the firm had spent its early years searching for a cause to anchor its endowment. At the time, modern slavery was getting considerable media attention from the war in Sudan. Women in Darfur were reportedly being captured by local militias and sold to troops in the capital. After a 2010 feature in National Geographic got the attention of co-founder Pam, the nonprofit set out to explore the issue in depth. The more they looked, the more they were stunned. Slavery, debt bondage, and forced labor were not extinct in our world, nor were they limited vestiges enabled by the chaos of war. They were vital forces underpinning the global economy. Over 35 million people per year work under coercion, more than the entire history of the Atlantic slave trade. And their labor is responsible for some $150 billion in profits per year. Footnote. Important if morally tricky point here. There's no legitimate way to compare modern slavery with the Atlantic slave trade, the latter of which is perhaps the single most destructive institution in the history of humanity. And so what I did up there was wrong and misleading, and mostly designed to get your eyes down here. I've elected to use the word slave liberally in this text because I think no other word hits with the appropriate impact when describing a person who's been simultaneously bought, sold, imprisoned, and forced to work under the threat of violence. But the Atlantic slave trade, with its basis in skin color, with its dynastic heritability, whereby humans born from slaves are born enslaved, and most critically by the fact that it was legal and upheld by the state, is unique and distinct and should not be used as some gauge point for the awfulness described. I'm of the opinion that these descriptions speak for themselves and need no gauge. I think I'm particularly sensitive to the morally trickiness here because many modern advocacy groups lump all forms of trafficked labor together to get aggressively high numbers for marketing purposes, lumping together people smuggled across borders for a fee, those working off a debt, and those like Tun Lin imprisoned for years against their will, creating numbers that are at the very least manipulative and at most at odds with meaning, misrepresenting people who are actually active agents in their own survival as victims. End footnote. Sex slaves, like the women in Darfur, represent less than a quarter. In many ways, the horror is so vast that it risks overwhelming anyone who learns about it. And so Humanity United did something unusual. Rather than plow in and fund direct action, it began to strategize. How do you create change around a problem that is so pervasive, invisible, and damning that most people just want to turn away and ignore? The first decision was to focus on forced labor in items we use, rather than the more sensational forms in the sex trade or domestic help market. At that time, there was no sourcing information on most global commodities, and so the firm hired outside consultants to begin what they called a, quote, strategic vetting process, producing quick snapshots of different industries. The result was mind-boggling. 25 commodities emerged from this analysis as candidates with extremely problematic supply chains. To narrow down their efforts, they focused on industries that were likely to achieve a media hit. Was the product imported in the United States in significant quantities? Would the severity of abuse shock consumers? 10 different commodities met these new criteria. Chocolate, coffee, shrimp, cattle, conflict minerals such as tungsten, cotton, timber, sugar, palm oil, and gold. In 2011, the group decided to elevate shrimp above all, publishing a massive, engrossing report aimed at policymakers. Brian Edge, the lead author, visited with the LPN while writing. He tells me no other group influenced his thinking or gave him the access on the ground the way the LPN did. At the same time, as it was publishing this report, Humanity United was also cultivating journalists, putting the Midyar's considerable resources into media partnerships and developing stories behind the scenes. In all, it was an extremely patient, calculated effort to move the global conversation, which leads to the most unusual aspect of forced labor in the Thai shrimp industry, the fact that you're hearing about it at all. It took an unusually deliberate billionaire's campaign combined with the raw engagement of a small group of community organizers to pull one small portion of the bottom of the commodity chain to a place where it was visible. Thus, by 2013, just as Pian and the LPN are hearing new terrible reports of a prison camp for enslaved workers, a brilliant team of reporters at The Guardian leveraged the Humanity United report to publish their own massive expose. This gets the hit the Omidyars had strategized around 5 years before. The media crashes down. Suddenly, seafood slavery is on the scene. The Associated Press comes next, digging even deeper to win a Pulitzer. The New York Times does a story. Then The Economist. Then everyone. Bangkok becomes a sea of white journalists and aid workers running around in metered cabs looking for seafood slaves to interview. I speak to one fisher who estimates he's given 300 interviews. For a brief moment, shrimp are added to the list of things a certain type of good middle-class person understood they aren't supposed to eat. This attention has made the people who study this sort of thing very uneasy. It isn't quite the worry of overexposure. It is the fear that we allow the horror of the specific to shield us from the horror of the overwhelming. A fear that shocking abuses like Tun Lin's on a boat will obscure the more mundane abuses of Tun Lin in the seafood processing plant. Think back on that moment. Tun Lin gets off the boat and finds alternate work. But then, because of conditions that don't outrage, conditions that fail the critical media test of murder, kidnapping, assault, just a paycheck being bled by overcharges for rent and electricity, an exploitation endemic to every one of those 25 problematic commodity chains, Tun Lin voluntarily returns to the boats where he was enslaved. Tunlin isn't stupid in the slightest. He just needs to survive. And he sized up those very normal, non-sensational, non-media-friendly conditions and decided they were worth risking going back on a fishing boat. Or consider what one shrimp supply chain expert told me. The focus on Thailand has brought so many resources, so many journalists, then policymakers here. But I believe if you put the same amount of resources and energy into other countries, you would find something similar. Another. This labor is 100% necessary across the globe. The whole system depends on it. It gives us the prices people have come to expect, and the profits. A third. There is nothing special about Thailand. A fourth. I do think the boats are extreme, but only in the violence. On the farm, you have the same exploitation, but you have people living in family units, so there are more social connections. The abuse can be quite terrible. The exploitation just as bad, but you don't have the extreme violence. A fifth. What I can say is that production has shifted to India now. And if you look at India and the volume of shrimp that they're producing, their history with the caste system, and the prices they're able to sell at, I don't see how they could not be having these problems. It just doesn't make sense otherwise. And as this media storm descends and Thailand gets elevated in world attention, grocery sellers are among the least well-equipped to respond. The moral fantasy is to raise prices. Perhaps a sign posted at the seafood counter saying, "Due to labor abuse in Thailand, the price of our shrimp is increasing as we work to ensure every person in our supply chain receives a fair wage." And then the store raises prices, sells the same amount of fish in defiance of the laws of supply and demand, and dutifully passes the increased revenue back up the chain in reverse to its importer, who passes it on to its manufacturer, who passes it on to a compromised supplier, one who's decided to turn a new leaf. Then the money's actually used by that supplier, reforming their recruitment process, expanding their human resources department, educating their workers on their rights, providing a pathway to grieve abuse, and finally, if there's any money left over, increasing wages. But even if all goes right, the money arrives intact, nobody in between gives themselves a raise, that last bit of work done by the supplier is incredibly hard. It will generate exactly zero press, since it is also searingly boring. And it is completely and utterly beyond the expertise of a grocery chain. There are NGOs devoted to this kind of work, who openly admit they barely understand the complexities of how to reform a supply chain. And then, even if you muster the moral courage to pursue this ideal, there is the entirely appropriate fear that a competitor down the street will simply hang a different sign. One that says, explicitly or implicitly, "Hi, valued customer, we've heard about the labor abuse in Thailand, and we would like to assure you that all our shrimp are sourced ethically," and continue to price right below you. Consider Margie Mason of the Associated Press, who won a Pulitzer Prize for reporting on child labor in the seafood industry. "When our story came out," she tells me, "Whole Foods was calling us and pleading, saying none of the shrimp from that plant got into their supply chain. And we were just baffled. How can you be sure? We're the people who informed your supplier. Are you saying you have closer oversight of your supplier's supply chain than they do? If so, how? Your exporter had no idea. Your importer had no idea. So how can you be so sure?" But they just kept pleading and pleading. It was crazy making. And so, to avoid the absolute hubris required above, most grocery sellers are much more likely to cut and run, drop the stigmatized supplier or region, and find a new area where they can make new promises. Industry observer Jim Prever calls this catering to the aesthetic sense of consumers who don't like to be associated with ugly things. It has the vanity of simplicity, the attraction of any moral absolute, but it rarely makes the world a better place. When the industry picks up and leaves, withdraws their money and purchasing power, the problems simply get shifted elsewhere. As industry moves, so do the problems, Daniel Murphy, Thai seafood supply expert, tells me. The global narrative is displacement. Too often during these media storms, I've heard people say, "Let's boycott this product," Simon Baker, a migrant researcher, explains. "Look at what happens when abused children get pushed out of labor markets. They typically don't suddenly find better jobs. They get pushed further underground. In my research, I've found this often means going into sex work." What you in the West have to realize is the entire narrative is backwards. In trafficking, the media focuses on why and where poor people get into difficult situations. But maybe we should be looking at why they are poor to begin with. And where was Pion during the Guardian media storm? Before the police, international aid workers, or media had heard of it, Pion left Thailand to follow up on reports about a prison camp run by boat owners. She went with one other friend to a lonely island at the tip of the Indonesian archipelago. For years, the LPN had heard rumors of men being held there, kept in cages, beaten for disobedience, in a place that had been chosen for its isolation, where there was no police presence, and where owners could punish fishers without killing them, because killing a slave in a labor shortage is expensive, but the fear a prison instills across the entire industry is quite lucrative. Together, these two women found the rumors were far worse than simply true. They found a private prison system with men held as long as 17 years, uncovered mass graves, and found fishers starving in the jungle, surviving on leaves and rodents, who had escaped from the prisons but had nowhere to go. The two women brought back whom they could with them and returned to alert authorities. Then they went back on their own to help more. At one point, Pion tells me, "We used to have fear. I used to be so afraid. Now we fear the fishermen will be dead. It has made us quite fearless." And this is how she does it. Camp wakes around 5:30 a.m. There's a slow gathering for breakfast, everyone crouching and scooping rice into bowls, going over the plans for the day as the sun creeps up. We're on the far edge of Songkhlaburi, very rural, very western Thailand, just a few miles from the Myanmar border. So everyone is practicing basic Mon words over breakfast, greeting stragglers in unison with what I think means hello. This section of the border is famously loose, barely demarcated in many places. And while there are no roads across, families travel back and forth by foot every day. This makes it a major migrant route for seafood, which is of course why the LPN is here. And so, a little after 6 a.m., still groggy, the whole group piles into a big church van, 16 deep, the aisle filled with interns, all scrunched into sleepy balls, heads resting on the thighs of the rest of us above in our seats. We hit the unpaved roads, jostling over ruts, the driver blasting crap Thai pop music that all the interns seem to know by heart and thus mouth silently and sleepily as we roll. By 7 a.m., the van thuds up on an empty soccer pitch, surrounded by abandoned buildings. Everyone piles out, shaking legs free. After a brief inspection of the ground, Pion selects a large building that is in the worst shape of all. This was once the cafeteria for a Mon elementary school, one that specialized in reaching out to that ethnic minority, but was abandoned from lack of funding and corruption. Bottles litter the floor. The main room is covered in dirt. The bathroom, with its one squat toilet, is essentially a waste pit, filled with rusted metal desks upturned on each other. Its identity as a school cafeteria is gone, and if you walked in and thought it was an actual junkyard, no one could argue. And then, after agreeing that this was the site, without so much as another word, everyone begins cleaning. Spreading out with the power of enthusiastic numbers, brooms are located, pulled from the van in two sections and twisted together, then dustpans, then rags, then trash bags flushed open. Soon a team is sweeping while another strings up posters, decorating, wiping, and physically hauling away the junk. I think of the maxim of the Young Lords, that the people may want liberation, but first they want their streets cleaned. And somehow, after only 45 minutes of this, 16 people bearing down with coordinated effort, there's something approximating a school shining back at us where previously there'd only been muck. Only once this space is reclaimed, the megaphones come out. Everything begins moving pretty fast at this point, it being almost 8 a.m. on a Sunday and nobody wanting to let the day get away. One team splits off to unload the large bags of donated gifts they've brought with them. Another begins arranging informational flyers, t-shirts, and a game with pictures illustrating legal and illegal trafficking scenarios. Others continue cleaning, now wiping down dust from windows. Four of the tallest interns take the megaphones and split in the four cardinal directions from the soccer pitch, calling out to the neighborhood in every language, announcing their presence, announcing the event, announcing the LPN will protect both the Thai and Burmese workers. And sure enough, like the Pied Piper or the ice cream truck, a steady stream of Mon children come pouring forth in response. These are little kids, no taller than my waist, and big kids in their teenage years, all coming into the now pristine cafeteria, many visibly taken aback by the cleanliness of the space, their space, recovered by this mysterious group with megaphones. As they come, the LPN puts the smallest ones into tight rows 10 deep sitting cross-legged on the floor, and lets the big ones head to the back where they can slouch cool against the wall. By 8:30 a.m., the room is almost three-quarters full, and to corral the growing crowd, an educator stands in the front of the room leading clap-based call-and-response activities that have the pacifying and unifying effect they're designed to have, but which I've never quite seen affected in the real world. While the children are the ostensible focus of the day, they are also reliable lures for the older and harder-to-reach mamas and papas and curious neighbors who've been attracted to this schoolhouse awakened. This older audience is crucial. They know migrants about to cross, workers in dangerous situations, and all of this energy is directed at getting them to believe too. Finally, just before the presentation is set to begin, the room filled with maybe 150 people now, packed to standing room capacity, three interns in salmon-colored t-shirts scale the walls by the windows, crawling towards the center rafter to unfold a giant banner, Border of Love, Border to See. Just about then, the call-and-response activities turn into a solid clap, a single rhythm, and I'll confess to a lump in the throat as this small organization managed to transform a corrupt, neglected school into a venue for 155 to 20-year-olds sitting in neat rows, chanting brotherhood and sisterhood in Thai and then Mon. For a brief moment, this is a community where people show other people they are linked, and through those links will be protected and informed. Its maintenance, of course, depends on the extent to which the rest of the chain joins in, forming new bonds of exchange, connected less by what we'll get and more by what we'll give.